Hi, everybody. My name is David Leeson. I'm your proud host of Leaders on the Frontier. And today, on April the 4th, 2024, the year of our Lord, we're delighted to have another live discussion with you, our audience, on both X and YouTube. So a warm welcome to all of you. I hope you're having a great spring right across our country. And we're delighted by the participation. We're getting thousands of people on our live discussion, and we really do appreciate your input. So make sure that you think about your questions that you want to pose. Make sure you like this and share it with your friends. We want to get the word out on very important issues that affect Canadians' lives. So we're really honored that you can join us today. So on that note, I'm very excited. I'm not sure what the best word to use is, but we have a very important topic today, and it's about eco-terrorism. And it's hard to believe in Canada, we don't think of our country, our peaceful Canada, where we value, pardon me, peace, order, and good government, that we don't think of terrorism existing right beneath our noses. Well, but that's been the story for the last several years. And my next guest is a senior researcher, associate at the Frontier Center for Public Policy. He's written a paper that was just issued this past week from Frontier about the topic of eco-terrorism. And the title of that paper, and I encourage you to look at it on the website, is The Deadly Fruits of Climate Change Alarmism, the Looming Eco-Extremist Threat, and Why We Must Stop Ignoring It. So I think that's quite a title and kind of summarizes where we're going today. We're going to talk about the terrorism that's occurring in our country that's really founded on the whole notion that we have a existential threat from climate change. And you may hear this all the time as the federal government just tabled record numbers of advertising dollars, some $16 million, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, where the federal government keeps the steady drumbeat that our climate is in deep crisis and that we face an existential threat. So I want to welcome Joseph Cornell, our associate at the Frontier Center. Joseph has an extensive research background on many different policy areas, from resource projects to the area of Indigenous policy. But Joseph is a very insightful policy analyst. So a warm welcome to you, Joseph. We're so glad you could join us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate the invitation, David. And it's a great topic, and I'm definitely willing to get into it.
Well, Joseph, I think you've done a masterful job here because you really lay out, I think, of both a strategic picture, but also one that's filled with really a lot of examples where eco-terrorism is really impacting the lives of Canadians. So let's start off with a really basic question. What the heck is eco-terrorism?
Well, it's extremism that's motivated by environmental causes, right? So, like, we're not talking about your average, environmentalism. That's a lot of it is very practical. It's reasonable, and usually, a good science-based. So, but we're talking about people that have usually taken certain environmental beliefs to a certain degree that they've reached a point where they believe that they can commit certain acts. So oftentimes it's sabotage or property damage or just intimidation of people. And as we'll get to later, in the UK, in Europe, we've seen examples where people motivated by this have created situations that have led to death, to some deaths, some bodily harm. So yeah, it's a lot of people, especially right now, right? We're looking at Gaza with Hamas on October 7th. We think, okay, those are terrorists, and everyone agrees on that. But when we talk about terrorism, we have to understand that it doesn't necessarily always mean death involved. It doesn't, that it's really the motive for what you're doing and what you're tr and why you're trying to do it, right? So if you have some kind of ideological, religious, or any type of belief that will motivate you to generally to kind of commit usually indiscriminate but not always, attack on innocent people, and usually for intimidation. And so, you know, it can involve bodily harm, but it can also involve property destruction or anything like that.
Okay. So this is pretty far-reaching stuff here. So eco-terrorism, if I'm understanding you, really is, there's a whole group of people, a network out there that attack property, in some cases even people, but they basically are functioning outside the law to create fear, to really intimidate people. They do a lot of enormous damage. I think there's example after example of this. So I want to just give one example, Joseph, that you outline and talk about, is this incredible project to bring liquefied natural gas across the West to the West Coast. And in Northern BC, well, it's called, well, can you tell us about this project and what happened essentially?
Well, so the Coastal Gas Link in particular, this project bringing LNG from Dawson Creek all the way to Kitimat, and then you know, to bring LNG to Asian markets, right, to Tidewater. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of opposition to it, not just on just strictly climate change related reasons, but also Indigenous reasons. A lot of people felt that Indigenous people weren't adequately consulted, and anyway, everyone saw this in late 2019 to 2020. We saw a bunch of elders with the Wet'suwet'en community, one particular First Nation along the route of Coastal Gas Link, that really got started doing what they call, I guess, in direct action. They call themselves land defenders, right? So it's usually a euphemism that's used, and they actually started becoming very confrontational, and that led to, you know, Canadians felt the impact of this. We all felt a lot of First Nations, but not exclusively, definitely a lot of non-Indigenous protesters and anarchists started using what they would call solidarity actions all across Canada. And so what we also saw, and this could kind of get into what we're talking about, there were rail blockades. And I remember, you know, a lot of Canadians remember that. People started noticing that, you know, when rails started getting delayed, they started the goods in grocery stores and heating oil. I remember out here, I'm out in Nova Scotia, there were solidarity blockades all the way to Dartmouth, to Halifax, that actually started interfering with propane shipments. That, you know, you had a lot of people on fixed incomes that were just complaining about, saying, but this is all based on the Coastal Gas Link and the Wet'suwet'en. And at the same time, right, you had a lot of non-Indigenous people that started engaging in acts of sabotage in support of them. And we can get into that. That's one of the ideological motivations.
To be clear, you had quite a network of environmental activists and others that wanted to stop the project, in spite of it also having considerable support from various First Nations across the line. And this is a massive project. I believe that the number of jobs really are in the numbers of thousands. And this will create enormous wealth and prosperity for all of Canada, but particularly for First Nations along the route, because there's a lot of agreements. But what's happened though is that you had blockages of national railway lines, and I believe you also had a series of violent acts, situations where protesters created fires on the property of the company involved, and even people wielding axes and destroying millions of dollars worth of property and threatening workers. So this was a significant action. People wore masks. This is a very serious action. And I know that police announced that they were searching for these armed protesters who were clearly violating the law on so many accounts. Has anyone been arrested to your knowledge?
No. So the RCMP did conduct an extensive investigation. There's a specialized unit within the RCMP that looks at attacks against the energy industry, like big infrastructure. So, and to its credit, I think the RCMP did establish that. But like you were saying, like the most prominent example was in February 2022, when 20 masked assailants entered a Coastal GasLink work site near Houston, British Columbia, and they intimidated security and workers. Workers had to flee, and they had flare guns, and they came onto the site, and they actually, so after they had left, they commandeered some of these vehicles and then used them to attack other vehicles. So there is, there's like tens of millions of dollars, according to the BC Contractors Organization, mm-hmm. that said mm-hmm. that was done that day. And for me, looking at that, for what I was saying before about the definition of terrorism, right? Ideological motivation to intimidate the public that could involve public, mm-hmm. Harm of people mm-hmm. and property damage, that qualifies, right? Mm-hmm. And before, even before that particular February event, like you were saying before, there were events out the Wet'suwet'en community. There definitely were. There were small scale, right? You had people coming in masks. Mm. They were stealing things. They were trying to sabotage, oil field equipment. They were trying to take vehicles. So, we didn't hear about these. We only heard, and not for very long. Even the February 2022 terror attack, I'm going to call it. This was happening all the time. Mm-hmm.
So these are significant acts of violence. I do remember very well the statements by elected chiefs by the First Nations coming together saying, these protesters, these people of violence, are terrorizing our communities. They're intimidating us. They're creating fear, and they're not welcome in our community. So this was in complete contrast with their message of somehow that they are the saviors of these communities, when in fact, the officials themselves of the First Nations that were duly elected were saying, you're not welcome. So I found that to be a very powerful example where you had people intruding in these First Nations, disrupting people's lives and exercising violence. So isn't that kind of ironic, Joseph, that that's part of the dynamic of what's going on with these so-called eco-terrorists?
Exactly. Like, we look at Wet'suwet'en, the elected chief, the Indian Act elected, granted, but those were the duly elected officials that represented that those First Nation communities. They signed an agreement with Coastal GasLink. And also, this was reaffirmed in a public vote on it. And so a group of what called themselves hereditary chiefs took upon themselves to claim that they could oppose this. Now, there's a lot of insider dirty laundry. I know some of the hereditary chiefs that were involved in this, and they're definitely, even within that body, there was a lot of disagreement about that. A lot of them felt that this particular segment of the hereditary chiefs were speaking on their behalf, and it's not a conspiracy or anything of that nature, because it's all been documented. We can send this. I can send you this so you can show the viewers and listeners that, Tides Foundation had funded these, this particular hereditary chiefs. They were behind this. There's a lot of money, right, involved in that. And so, these First Nations, in the strongest terms, and a lot of First Nation organizations came out. The First Nation LNG Alliance came forward and said, this is not our way. This is against our teachings. We don't mm-hmm. condone this. But if you look at the actual the whole situation that led to the February attack, there's one individual mm-hmm. by the name of Molly Wickham, who she's an Indigenous person, and she claims to represent this community, the hereditary chiefs, although some people question that, where she was on Facebook and she went on an anarchist podcast where she said we need allies among environmentalists and among the anarchist groups, like specifically the anarchist groups. And then not long after that, we have the February attack. And so CBC, to its credit, and a second time, wrote an article talking about the influence of anarchists. And they asked Molly Wickham in particular, they asked her the tough questions. They said, look, you're trying to disassociate yourself from what happened here, but you were specifically calling, for allies. And you shouldn't be surprised when some people answered your call, right? And so there are, when the RCMP investigated this, they looked at all the chatter online and they found some particular anarchist groups. It's always in the major cities in Canada. And there's one in particular in Montreal. It's based in Montreal. It's called the Montreal Counter Information. And it's a anarchist-based website. Now, I don't want to give these guys any clicks, but you have to see it to believe it. It's Montreal Counter Information. Go in there. Talking about acts of sabotage. And in particular in Coastal GasLink, I think I'd mentioned this before. They found a post anonymously, of course, where someone said that there was like six or seven or eight, I can't remember the exact number, of they said, look, we're going to commit, we could commit any of these possible six to eight acts of sabotage on pipelines. One of them was involving poking holes in the pipeline. And they said, but most of them aren't true, but two of them are. So, right, they're playing a game. And so this led the RCMP to obviously look at this and say, you know, these are some of the people. And if you go to that website, you'll see very clearly, and not just Coastal GasLink, there's all kinds of acts against projects that are ongoing. Right now, there's an electric vehicle battery plant called Northvolt. It's a Swedish company.
Can I just back up for just
yeah, go ahead.
A second,
Sorry.
Joseph? Because honestly, yeah. You have packed a lot into the last minute here. So you're saying that when we talk about hereditary chiefs, what does that mean? Are these people that have a kind of a bloodline and that somehow they have a kind of a ceremonial importance? What's going on there? What do you mean by hereditary?
Okay, chiefs? Yeah, sorry, I should clarify that. So hereditary chiefs, they're unelected. They're hereditary. So it's a passed down position. It's to recognize the importance of family and clan within First Nations societies, in particular British Columbia. So it's not often outside. And so that's a very legitimate thing with First Nations in British Columbia, a lot of the Pacific Northwest First Nation tribes. And what the distinction is that hereditary chiefs speak to an older form of Indigenous governance before the Indian Act was imposed through the Indian Act. So generally, because they're through different families, the chiefs are responsible for certain areas, like regions within the traditional territories that might even extend outside the actual reserve line, right, created by the Indian Act. So they're responsible for those things. So there's a very legitimate thing with that. But right now, it's a pre-modern institution that's interacting with a modern in the sense of the Indian Act elected. And so you have a lot of First Nations that are still really navigating how do we do governance with traditional, the old school like in BC, and the new governance. But what happens in this case is some hereditary chiefs that in this particular case of the Wet'suwet'en, a lot of the connections are those or people that claim to be hereditary chiefs, it's suspect, right? There's a concern about money,
really? Okay.
Influencing, like I was saying, about these things. And it comes into conflict that if certain people say, you know, we're opposed to this pipeline project, but the elected chief and councillors and members support it, what do you do, right?
Okay. But to be clear, the hereditary chiefs come out of a more traditional, dare I say, aristocratic form of governance from long ago. And some may falsely claim that they're of hereditary background. There's a number of examples of that. But in addition to that, we have the democratically elected officials that do have decision-making power under the Indian Act. They're democratically elected. And they're very much in favor of this project. And yet you have a handful of hereditary chiefs that have come forward. And it's interesting because it's been confirmed that they've been funded, they've been paid significant salaries by the Tides Foundation. So what is the Tides Foundation, Joseph? Help us understand that.
So it's a foundation, it's the United States. It's a foreign-funded foundation that...
It's out of the United States.
Yes, like it started, and we have Tides Foundation Canada, and so there are a lot of. So what the Tides Foundation as a foundation is that it funds environmental organizations. In particular, it tends to fund initiatives. There's very much evidence, you know, looking at the Tides Foundation, how it's connected to things that are attacking the energy sector. So opposing pipelines, all kinds of these projects. I think the Allen Inquiry in Alberta years ago traced a lot of this money, and it found a significant amount. Like there's more money for environmental non-governmental organizations than political parties and different things in Canada. So,
Can you repeat that? What did you just say?
There are more like environmental organizations, like the foundations. They're more well resourced than political parties in Canada.
Wow.
So I
think a lot of Canadians would be shocked to hear that. There's literally tens of millions of dollars, largely foreign money, pouring into Canada to orchestrate these kinds of campaigns against the oil sands, oil campaigns vis-a-vis funding groups that are really violent and waging terrorist acts on both property and people in this country. That's really the bottom line, isn't it, Joseph?
Well, there's funding coming in, and they're not, I don't think there's any effort to actually trace how it's being spent or what kind of tactics, right? Like when I was a student back, an undergrad at McGill University, I followed a lot of the protest movement, right? This was, you know, the Free Trade Area of the Americas was in Quebec City. And you had groups that were called they were calling themselves the Black Bloc, BLOC. And they wore masks, of course, and they would be the ones that would come in and do damage. They would smash ATMs and things like that. And what I noticed was
why do they wear masks, Joseph?
If to hide
their cause, why aren't they prepared to be identified? Why do they wear masks?
I think it to hide their identity, to avoid prosecution, that if you go in there and what I noticed was that all these protests, there were a lot of people there for, you know, they were very legitimate, that, you know, they had good causes in some respects, but you would have this usually, these are protests on those associated with the left. They wouldn't criticize those who would do these kinds of things, these Black Bloc or, and what they did was they called it like, we respect a diversity of tactics. So what you discover, what that means is that if there's someone that's like you're on a protest and you're just walking down the street and there's a guy beside you, I know Garen to get a fight with the cops or to damage, you know, an ATM or something like that, you wouldn't criticize that person. Like you would respect a diversity of tactics in quotation marks. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when we're talking about extremism on the left, in particular, is what we're talking about here. That's part of the problem is that that kind of violence or intimidation was normalized and no one wanted to criticize, right? It's like when, you know, you see a protest, like say even the convoy, and if someone goes off and does something, like you had examples of, you know, there were people that apparently interfered with a homeless shelter or something like that with food or something that was associated with the convoy. Mm-hmm. You had people right away disassociate themselves from those kinds of things and say, no, we don't, these guys don't speak for us. So you see that this is part of the problem. I think that, you know, we're not taking a stand and, you know.
Well, this is very concerning. I'm talking with senior research associate with the Frontier Center, Joseph Cornell, about a paper that he recently completed called The Deadly Fruits of Climate Change Alarmism, the looming eco-extremist threat and why we must stop ignoring it. So, Joseph, this paper is certainly an eye-opener, and I encourage anyone to look at it, and I also welcome your questions. But what would you say is the main conclusion from your analysis? I mean, you look at it very closely. What was the main conclusion that you make in this paper?
Well, the paper, I would call it's an impassioned plea to not ignore this, like to take off the blind spots. And the problem that I identify is that, and shockingly to me, that even security agencies, right, CSIS, Public Safety Canada, even to a certain degree, the RCMP, are they're very focused on extremism associated with the right. You know, they identified as incel, anti-vax, you know, even things on gender ideology, but they're ignoring, you know, extremism that's coming from the left. And I think we need to, all institutions that you know, the government, media, security agencies need to stop this, and they need to focus, because this is, it's getting worse. It's not getting better, in the sense that, so I called it the deadly fruits of climate change alarmism, that I think that a lot of the, not like mainstream climate change views that a lot of people have, but a more, a very unscientific, apocalyptic views that go well beyond what the science is telling us. Like, and you're starting to see some pushback from this, which is good, but the like the IPCC report, if you read the technical reports, like the scientific stuff.
What is the IPPC?
Oh, I'm sorry, the interprovincial, the interpanel, the international panel on studying climate change. Excuse me, that by the United Nations, that came out and is very influential. I'm just saying, sorry, that kind of set the standard, the gold standard for how we think about climate change. So if you read the actual technical reports, like where the scientists are talking, you know, they look at climate change and they look at the serious problems with that, but they're very cautious, they're very tentative, and they're not alarmist, right? They say things could change, like this might not, and they actually assign percentages. And there are a lot of things that are not high. Like example, like I was just reading something that blew my mind, that a lot of these extreme weather events that we're seeing, it's actually, there's a lot of high probability that a lot of them are not associated with human-caused climate change. So, and I think that there are a lot of people that, if you're very motivated by alarmist, apocalyptic scenarios that aren't based in science and get very extreme, then I think that that's a breeding ground for radicalization, right? Like in Europe, you have a group called Just Stop Oil, which formed in 2022, which intended to, their goal was to stop the United Kingdom from any new fossil fuel licenses. And one of their tactics is to stand in the road and prevent people from going, like in front of cars. And they're starting to cause a big problem. But if you read their, like their, what do you call it? Like their charter, like why they were started, it's very based on extremist rhetoric. It's not the tentative, nor rational, science-based climate change. It's hyper. It's like climate change rhetoric on steroids, right? Like very intense.
So we're in a situation here where it is interesting that there's a lot of much more measured comments, certainly out of the United Nations now, saying that there is no existential threat from climate. I think actually the chairperson of the panel came out of that just this fall and stated that. But it's almost like you've got a set of operatives, largely political activists, that take any of that kind of information and magnify it. I can hear the young Swedish woman Greta Thunberg holding up her finger and wagging at us right now, saying, "How dare you?" So yes, it's almost like people, some are using this type of concern about the environment in the extreme. They are extremists, and what I find fascinating about your insight here in your paper, Joseph, and I again encourage people to look at it, is how so much of this extremism has been normalized in so many of the narrative on the political side. And so where does a lot of this kind of narrative come from within our institutions? Because it's certainly not based on the facts and evidence before us. Yeah. Where is it coming from, Joseph? Yeah.
So just before I will answer that, I just gonna, this is Just Stop Oil. So I'm looking at this, and this is kind of their raison d'etre. The group claims extracting new fossil fuels will kill our children, condemn humanity to oblivion, and that human-induced climate change will destroy human civilization unless emergency action is taken to rapidly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to zero in a very short timescale. Now, that is very much beyond the pale of what scientists and rational people looking at climate change who believe it's real and human-caused are saying. So it's very, it's ideological. In terms of it is coming about in universities. As an example, I mentioned this a lot in the paper. There is a professor of human ecology, a Swedish gentleman by the name of Andreas Malm, who I discovered that he wrote a book that was called How to Blow Up a Pipeline.
He wrote a book about how to blow up a pipeline.
Yes. I watched an interview. Okay. I watched an interview, a podcast for the New Yorker, and someone was kind of chiding him, saying, well, you know, a lot of people might take this seriously that you're talking about this. And he was saying, well, it's true. This is exactly what I'm talking about. And Malm, he's a university professor and taking public money and teaching students. And he talked about in this podcast how where he started was he deflated tires of SUVs, vehicles, in his area where he grew up. And that's how he started. Mm-hmm. And really what happens is you have people that really believe, if you have people believe that it's non-scientific, saying that the earth is on fire, they will increasingly become more radical because they have, it's a self-righteous belief. It's like, but it's sincerely held, I believe, that people think that drastic things require drastic measures. And that's what's happening, that these people like Malm and others start believing that in order to, we need to sabotage energy sector infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I noticed was, I put this in the paper, in the United States, there was an actual law that was introduced where some Republican mainly, but not exclusively, legislators called for the FBI to investigate and to eco-terrorism, and saying, look, and it was actually partly inspired by Malm and other academics who are saying this kind of stuff, right? This hyper apocalyptic rhetoric, and very damaging, right? And
indeed.
Yeah.
So I'm talking with Senior Associate Joseph Cornell about eco-terrorism. What do you think? Well, one of the questions I have here is probably the best question we've had so far, and that is, what can we do to stop these people? Joseph?
Well, in the paper, I argue that the United Kingdom, it's just in response to Just Stop Oil and Extinction Rebellion, which the second one is an organization that operates in Canada. I think that what they did in the UK was, once these people, and I'm not talking about, you're not prosecuting average environmentalists or people with sincerely held reasonable beliefs, but people who take tactics. And in the UK, they started listing these organizations. They started saying Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil. These groups pass from lawful advocacy to violent extremism. And then we need to deal with that. And they had a system where you could, just like CSIS has a thing that if you suspect someone of extremism or terrorism, they might hurt other people, you can report that. Mm-hmm. And the UK, they started. So part of the problem for me was when I started investigating this, I looked at CSIS and I didn't see these kind of organizations listed. I saw the traditional Islamist organizations that we think about. Mm-hmm. And, we had a lot of groups that are associated with the organizations. Like in the 70s and 80s, we had groups like the Earth Liberation Front, Earth First, the Animal Liberation Front. I don't know if these are familiar to you, David, or some other. So environmental extremism that is motivated by environmental beliefs, it started with those kind of groups, right? You had groups that they would spike trees, like old growth forests. And for animals, they would break into labs. They would use explosive devices. And so that was the 70s and the 80s. That was environmental extremism. But now it's morphed to, now it's mainly motivated by climate change rhetoric, like very hyper radical. And I think so having the courage to identify these groups and that people can report them. And I think, and prosecuting, right? Like, and I think, like, one of the things that we are seeing in Europe and in Canada, and people could Google this, you see some environmentalists motivated by a belief in climate change damaging priceless art, right, in museums and art galleries. We've seen that all over. And in Europe,
so rather you're referring than, to where, say, in the National Gallery in London,
right,
eco-terrorists coming up and literally putting some type of food material, like a soup, on a precious piece of art.
Yeah, like spill paint. Yeah, on the Mona Lisa, right? Yeah. Like throw paint.
Yeah.
And in British Columbia, I believe there was a. Then it's starting to happen in Canada. So rather than say, okay, that's just you know what they're saying, just prosecuting that and starting with tactics like that. Mm-hmm. I think, like, one example was with Just Stop Oil. Was they would put themselves on the road. So I don't see this in Canada, and I hope this is what I'm hoping for this paper that it leads to. We don't allow this, is people lying on the road on major in London and, you know, stopping people from going. And besides really annoying people and people getting very upset, like emergency vehicles, like ambulances and fire response units have been limited because of this. And in one case, and I mentioned it in the paper, someone associated with Just Stop Oil climbed onto a bridge in London. And so what it did was that caused a detour, right? People couldn't use the bridge as the police came to respond. And it caused chaos in all people that were traveling in London, and they had to go to on an alternate route. And it led to some traffic, and it led to some traffic accidents. And two women died as a result of a collision due to their injuries that is associated with the fact that that bridge was blockaded by Just Stop Oil people. So
this is not only a policy issue then that not only impacts the livelihood of people in terms of energy prices and all kinds of things, but it has a profound impact on human life. I mean, these people are literally endangering, if not killing, people when they block traffic and do all kinds of other things. I mean, I think the example of blocking national railway lines is reprehensible, like the amount of monies, and that went on for weeks, and nothing was done. So I guess for me, and this is a fascinating part of your analysis, Joseph, is, and you've alluded to this, it begs the issue, where are our institutions? In this country, in Canada, we have what's referred to as the rule of law. And the rule of law isn't just simply the application of the law equally to different parties. It involves having professional, the ability of police to do even enforcement. It also involves courts being able to apply the law in a way that provides a sense of justice being done. I mean, there's a variety of aspects of our institutions that allow the rule of law. And it seems to me that your paper really identifies how these institutions are kind of in doubt as they kind of genuflect, as they kind of bow before these kinds of eco-terrorists and basically give them a free pass. I mean, to this day, there's not one single charge I can think of regarding the Coastal Link gas line violence. I mean, that's reprehensible, is it not? I mean, how hard is it, difficult is it to find people who, it was in an isolated area. How hard is it to find these dozens of operatives running around? I mean, surely people know and suspect who these individuals are.
Yeah. The RCMP is definitely believes this was outside agitators. So they were very, they wanted to disassociate from the First Nations involved and saying that these are outside.
Yes.
But like you're saying, these people were before the February 2022 attack, these kinds of people were very evident. They were out doing things in British Columbia, out where the Wet'suwet'en, the work sites, they were there already. So yeah, and to extent of, you know, the police were dealing with them. The RCMP was ongoing. They had to enforce an injunction on them a couple times. So they could see where these guys are. So unless, we find out a conviction, impending conviction on that, which I hope, then But in terms of the Wet'suwet'en, like the blockades that happened in Canada, that definitely affected the economy. Like, my interest in this paper started back when I looked at the convoy, actually, and I looked at how the media was covering the convoy, and it struck me how differently the media was framing and looking at those people versus the Wet'suwet'en solidarity events the year before, right? You know, that we had amazing amounts of sabotage and affecting that. If you look at in terms of, you know, with the emergencies legislation, the Wet'suwet'en solidarity, that what that really was a national issue, because it went from coast to coast, even it went up to the, you know, so, but you look at the convoy, right? That was pretty localized to Ottawa, unless you count the blockades, which are separate, right? So I looked into that and I started to notice that these things were being treated differently. You know, like the media was focusing on convoy, trying to link it to foreign-funded extremists, which we know now is false, right?
I remember the CBC was suggesting, could it be Russian-funded?
Yeah. And then from there, it led to a whole, when I looked at, so what people need to know is like, between when the government invoked the emergencies emergency legislation against the convoy from the this Coastal GasLink terror attack, they're days apart, like 4 days. And to me, those stand in stark contrast in terms of one, what actually was a real terrorist attack that the media largely ignored. And to this day, that, like, yes, like the prime minister condemned it and a lot of, like, you saw that, but it lasted a day or two, right? The CBC, this is one thing that I really bothered me. The first time when the CBC looked at the Coastal GasLink issue, they the Fifth Estate, right, their flagship investigative reporting program, covered the whole issue. They covered that particular unit within the RCMP, and it was really attempt to demonize them, okay? And it was a 45-minute or so segment. But in terms of the February 22nd, the 2022 attack, that they mentioned that it was about 20 to 40 seconds of 40 minutes at the very end of the segment too, right? So if you're going to marginalize that, I was like, why is this not the focus of this documentary? Why is this not, you know, but the you know, so my background is in journalism, and I was astounded by the, not just CBC, but the lack of journalistic curiosity, right? Like looking into these groups, why did they do this? And CBC, the second time, did a good piece to its credit about anarchists, but really ignored their ideological motivation. Like, they didn't talk about their beliefs very much.
So one of your points then, if I'm understanding you correctly, Joseph, is that the media is really a very important institution in our society, but they're kind of enabling, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are they enabling this eco-terrorism to happen?
I think they are when they downplay it. When Professor Andreas Malm from Sweden, the Swedish human ecologist, when he wrote that book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, he was platformed by the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine, The Nation. All of these publications gave him a platform to normalize this. And it was almost like this, and I read one in the, I think it was Harper's Magazine, also about a gentleman in the United States that went around to power plants based on an idea that he felt that these were leading to the destruction of climate change and things like that. So if you can imagine someone talking about blowing up, you know, how to blow up a journalism at credential schools, but that we didn't hear very much about, right? So I definitely think that, and I'm a journalist by training, that's kind of my background, but there's a lot of empirical evidence that looks at journalists and does find that there is a and particularly public, but all journalists generally have a more, they sit more on the left. And I think that when it comes to extremism associated with the right, they amplify that and they make it worse. And when it's the left, they just kind of say, okay, well, you know, they might be misunderstood, and they provide a just, you know, they try to downplay it. And yeah, it's definitely, that needs to be addressed. And I think if it wasn't for some independent media, opinion media, like, you know, True North and other sources, Rebel Media, that were actually talking about this, we wouldn't really hear this, right? We wouldn't know what's going on.
I think there's another dimension to eco-terrorism, and it, and I think you've kind of alluded to this, Joseph. And in my mind, it begs the issue, like, one of the great strengths of our nation has been the ability to have healthy, respectful debate. We can disagree with each other, but we can arrive at, in the search for truth, things that we can learn from each other as we try to improve society. And I know that sounds awfully cheesy, but it is true. We can do these discussions in a way that respects each other. That is at the heart, in many respects, of good citizenship. But in this case, it almost seems like we've got people, if I use the metaphor of hockey, that are not even on the rink. They're not wanting to play by the same rules.
No.
They're wanting to go after people, physically attack your property. And this is really an assault on the Canadian people. This is an assault on their peace of mind and confidence that they can go confidently to their, whether they're on a First Nation, a city, any community in our country. And this violates their confidence that we live in a peaceful civil society where we can get along with each other. And I think this is very concerning. And it, you know, it begs, in my mind, the question, if our institutions do not prosecute this and don't apply a uniform, fair law, then it goes to figure that there's no surprise why so many people hold our institutions in less and less regard and trust. This is a downward spiral, is it not, Joseph?
Yes, it definitely is. I think, you know, people, the usual caveat, right? Like, you, we have free speech, but you can't shout a fire in a crowded room, a theater. That there's lawful advocacy, and we have to trust, people have to trust the battle of ideas, that they have credible ideas that can win people's minds, their hearts and minds. But when you blockade something, when you blow up something, when you sabotage energy infrastructure, that's not free speech. That's intimidation. That's terrorism in some extreme cases. So it has to be. It has to be like, you, even right now in Canada, like, when, you know, with the Gaza going on right now, you had a lot of people coming out, which is their right, right, on both sides. But then you had sometimes in Toronto, you had some pro-Palestinian groups were congregating at certain areas that were very much close to Jewish neighborhoods or synagogues or places of worship, Jewish schools, and the authority said that's not free speech anymore. That is intimidation. That is harassment. You're deliberately like, you have a right to say anything you want, but you don't have a right to do anything you want, or anywhere you want, right? And I think those of on the other side would say, well, we saw with the convoy, people couldn't stay forever in Ottawa and doing what they did, and you know, and so eventually you have to say that you've made your point. And people say with some value that, you know, protest or civil disobedience is about somewhat making people feel uncomfortable, and I get that, and sometimes but that can extend to like bodily harm. Like if you lay down on a road and you prevent an ambulance from getting to someone that needs to get critical care, I'm sorry, your beliefs, you might think in your mind that they justify it, but it's not, they never do. And I think that that's what the thing with a lot of the radical, with the very unscientific, where the climate change, that people are believing that if they literally believe the earth is on fire, if it's going to, humans are going to be extinct within 5 years, which is not true. It's not by the IPCC. It's not, they're not, no one's saying that, right? Then you take the step in your own righteousness that you can, oh, well, this justifies me blowing this up, or this, that's the crux of terrorism, right? My cause outweighs the right to human safety or human life or the public sense of safety, right? So we got to deal with
it. So I think that's a very good point, is that we kind of cross the Rubicon, if you will, as Caesar crossed the Rubicon River by Rome, where people really do believe the ends justify the means. So the cause is that morally justified that they can basically put other people's lives in jeopardy because they believe that they are so good and great in terms of their own moral self-righteousness that they can just simply bully and harass our nation. So this is, very well said, Joseph, in terms of your call to not ignore this anymore. And I think that this is should be a wake-up call to different decision makers. I think the question is, as we get to the close of our discussion, is what can we do about it as citizens? I mean, should we be calling our elected representatives and saying, what the heck is going on, when we have all these myriad of violent acts and terrorism against Canadians, including brothers and sisters that are of First Nation background? You're of Aboriginal background. You must hear it from all kinds of people, as I do, in First Nation communities, that they're horrified by this. We have grinding poverty in different First Nations. And one of the key things, as we talk with leaders such as Dale Swampy and so many others, that we need to develop our resource sector as an example so that we can lift everybody into prosperity and opportunity. But so what can we do as citizens, Joseph? Are there some particular actions we should be undertaking?
I think the first step, I guess, on the climate file. So we're taking the, forgive the pun, like bringing the temperature down, right? That, you know, if you hear people using alarmist rhetoric or something, or you're at your school, right? And I noticed this, to me, that's the tragedy, is that this is causing serious climate anxiety. They're calling that, it's a real phenomenon with particularly children, that they think that in 5 years,
mental health issues.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Issues yeah. are being facilitated by these people that should know better, including teachers,
yeah.
right?
And I think that needs to do the temperature bringing down. I think to not allow this to be normalized. I think, you know, if you see at your university close to you, they're having someone who thinks that these tactics are justified, or someone says something in whatever a campus newspaper that is normalizing like an attack, like Coastal GasLink, or what Just Stop Oil's doing, that, you know, oh, it's all justified because we're trying to protect the planet. You need to you say no. You know, someone needs to say no, that's not right, and direct them. You know, I think universities, academic freedom should be wide, and I'm not saying it should not be wide. There should be a lot of discussion and vigorous discussion, but I think that universities, when they start talking about sabotage or physical damage or threatening things to people that could affect people's bodily integrity, universities should not be associated with that. Like, they should be, because we all know that if it was something associated with the right or something else, universities would say, no, we can't allow that, right? And so I think universities, I think, you know, calling media when we see bias, calling out those things. And I think, and at an extreme thing, I think that, you know, if you're hearing people that are talking about very extreme tactics like this, I think, you know, this is something that might warrant intervention from the you know, security agencies. Like CSIS has de-radicalization programs, but it usually for involving Islamists, right? Because that's the bulk of terrorist organizations in recognizing Canada are Islamist in origin. And they have de-radical, and they have ways to intervene in communities to stop people from getting any further. And I think in the United Kingdom, they have some of that with very extreme environmental groups that if you report someone, you know, I'm not saying, you know, don't report everyone that, you know, but if you start hearing things about blowing up and, you know, and things like that, you might help someone become worse, right? Down the radicalization.
So if you had to summarize the number of actions, one of the things we need to do is encourage institutions to do their job, to enforce the law. Let's don't have these double standards. I think what you cited earlier is incisive, where in the UK, as an example, they're naming groups that have been linked based on evidence to violence. So really raising a flag around that, saying that's inappropriate. That's not how our peaceful democratic society works. We don't intimidate or bully people into submission. We have healthy debate. I think the other thing that you've cited is the importance of people speaking up with their elected representatives. And I guess what you're alluding to is also very fascinating, Joseph, in the sense that are we dealing with such an extreme ideology? And I don't pretend to be a psychologist, but it begs the issue to what extent this is almost a religion for some of these people. It's where they find meaning in their life, where somehow, again, they feel justified that the ends justify the means, that violence is somehow appropriate to undertake. Is that something that you picked up in your research as well, that this is essentially a religion?
I definitely think that, you know, as societies become more secular, people are looking at this as like a form of religion. I think, you know, we have texts, sacred texts associated with it. One thing that I noticed in that when there was a House of Commons.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean by sacred texts associated with this?
Well, just like in environmental books that have come out by various authors that people tend to like, you know, this, you know, how to blow up a pipeline or how to that, you know, all of these organizations that I studied, they definitely, they have seminal texts and they have things and statements that they have. If you go on, usually on their website, they'll post things. And so it's a very fervent dedication to this. And it is very much they've utilitarian logic to them, that the end justifies the means, consequentialist logic, whatever, you know, and moral philosophy that they've adopted, that it doesn't matter. Like, but it's just all the nuance, right, is lost, of course, right? Yeah. Like with these kinds of things.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, when I look at this issue, can't thank you enough, Joseph, for your analysis, because really this issue of eco-terrorism has significant impacts in our society, and we did not even dwell on it significantly, but I can't help think of the whole theme of prosperity. When we look at, I believe it was last month, some $48.6 billion of business capital, if memory serves me correctly, left this country. Now, those are very significant movements where money is leaving your country because you're not seen as a stable, viable place to do business, to build a place, you know, brimming with opportunity, jobs and opportunity. And in that environment, that's really the foreshadow of a declining standard of living. And this is the brutal reality that we're facing. I think that this type of act of eco-terrorism really moves our country more and more in that direction of decline. And I think this is, in my mind, a tragedy, because it not only undermines the life of our fellow Canadians, but future Canadians. It's the next generation that's going to pay the big price when it comes to our inability to think clearly and compassionately, but firmly, on ensuring the rule of law survives in this country. Am I looking at this too dramatically, Joseph?
No, you're looking at it. It's right. A lot of it is some of these organized interests are trying to sabotage our energy sector to landlock us even more. And I think for the First Nation thing, they do a very discredit to the Indigenous people that they think they're helping. But you look in Canada, most First Nations are that they're located near resource projects, a lot of with the energy projects, so involving fossil fuels that need to be developed. And so these projects are key, But you have a lot of these groups that think that they are decolonizing and they're sticking it to the oil industry and for First Nations when they're actually hurting the First Nations in their communities and their prosperity, like you said.
But isn't that ironic? How dare they, to coin Greta Thunberg,
exactly.
How dare they go into First Nation communities and tell them that they can't prosper when in fact their democratically elected leaders are saying, bring it on. So anyways, this is unbelievable.
It's eco-colonialism.
Analysis, Joseph.
Yeah.
It's what did you call it?
It's called eco-colonialism, where they're trying to telling First Nations what to do for an environmental cause.
There it is. We've learned yet again another word from Joseph Crennel. We're so grateful that you could join us today, Joseph. And I want to thank you on behalf of all of us, including our audience, for your incredible work and your courage in terms of this analysis. So thank you.
No problem. Thank you. Welcome. It's been a great opportunity. Appreciate it.
And thank you, everyone, our audience, for joining us today. Thank you for your questions. And we certainly appreciate your likes and sharing this very important type of information and discussion with your friends. And we certainly welcome your feedback as usual. So we look forward to our next discussion next week, next Thursday, at the same time and same place. And have a terrific day. Thank you.